We want to begin today's edition of State of the News. Again, I'm Rick Howlett, and we begin, as always, with our WFPL News Roundtable. Gabe Bullard, Aaron Keene, Philip M. Bailey, and Devin Katayama are here. I think I got everybody. We have such a newsroom now.
It's crowded in here.
Very crowded.
I have enough chairs for everybody. We'd like to hear from you as well. If you have any thoughts about the topics we're discussing, 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can also send us an email if you'd like at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet at WFPL News or reach us through our Facebook page. Well, Gabe, let's start with Occupy Louisville. They received word yesterday, the movement downtown, that their permit will not be extended or renewed.
Right. This has been a matter of contention between Occupy and the city for a long time. 6 months ago, in fact, Occupy just had a celebration for its six-month anniversary. Months ago, there was a lot of confusion around where the camp was actually going to be. They were sleeping on the Belvedere. They were down at Jefferson Square Park. It was a lot of confusion. They eventually got a permit for Jefferson Square Park and were camping out there. The city asked them to move to Founders Square late last year. And then when Occupy sought to extend their permit for Founders Square, the city said no. The city said after December 31st, you're going to have to take the tents down. You can gather here in the daytime, but you can't sleep here. There was a big discussion about how many of the people who were camping were actually homeless and how many were people who had come down to join the protest. And after some legal action and some other wrangling, the city granted a temporary permit. That temporary permit is what is not being renewed now, and Occupy has largely come to terms with this at this point. The city says that Founders Square has become more of a homeless camp than ever. The Occupy folks don't deny that there are a lot of homeless people camping out there, staying in the tents overnight. A lot of the people I talk to who say they're members of Occupy don't camp out there anymore. They go in the daytime for some of the meetings and to use the park as a gathering place, but they said a lot of the people sleeping overnight are homeless. Now, they say that doesn't mean that they're not protesting. It just means that they also don't have another place to go.
Well, a cynic might say, well, we're getting close to Kentucky Derby time.
that as well, and that's something the city has its mind on, and they're planning right now a $7,000 cleanup effort for the park after Friday. They don't expect that they're going to have to force anyone out of the park. They think a lot of people are going to leave already, but the city is planning to reseed all the grass and do some other things to clean up around there.
Well, the city, there have been a few incidents, but the city has had a pretty good relationship over the months with the Occupy folks as far as keeping things clean in that area. And the police have had a good relationship with them as well.
Yeah, there's only been actually one clash and one group of arrests ever, and that was with one of these Occupy working groups that is a protest outside of Chase Bank in the Highlands. They had clashed with police a little bit, and that was really the first time there were any physical altercations with Occupy and the police. Before that, the relationship had been very cordial with the city, and we saw some increased security around other Occupy protests after those arrests at Chase Bank, but there really wasn't any other action after that. And some of that is being blamed from various people on the splintering inside of Occupy, that this Founders Square encampment has become less of a central location for Occupy, and they're starting to do more organizing online. They're doing more organizing through phone calls and all of that. And these working groups, like the one that protested outside of Chase Bank, there are more of those organized. They've also now rented office space, and they say that this office space they have at the Braden Center at 34th and Broadway in West Louisville is going to really take the place of that, since they've been having a hard time doing any sort of organizing from this media tent in Founders Square.
All right. Thank you very much, Gabe. Let's turn to Philip M. Bailey. Philip, you reported this week. Well, first of all, President Obama had some pretty strong words for the U.S. Supreme Court as the arguments were held on his health care plan that has become law. And then Senator Mitch McConnell delivered a speech in Kentucky this week. He had some strong words for President Obama.
Yeah, it was sort of a war of words between these two, which shouldn't surprise that many. Earlier this week, speaking at the Rotary Club in Lexington, Senator Mitch McConnell, he responded to President Obama's comments earlier in the week about the Supreme Court. Many people were surprised that on Monday, the president, when talking about the health care law that was before the court, he criticized judicial activism. Usually that's something you hear from conservative critics, saying that judges are making decisions that are undermining and overturning laws and undermining the will of the voters. The president made a similar sort of comment saying that, you know, he warned against the justices as an unelected group overturning the legislation, saying that it would be unprecedented for them to do that. Many legal scholars came out, including President Obama's mentor at Harvard, saying that that's not unprecedented. That's, in fact, what the Supreme Court is supposed to do. So Senator McConnell came out yesterday and said basically for the president to back off, that he isn't trying to intimidate the justices and trying to intimidate the court. Some legal scholars have said that this could actually backfire and hurt him, the fact that the justices won't listen to the president. They may, in fact, be more willing to overturn the law because of his comments. So it's because, you know, the president's health care law has been a contentious issue really since it passed, even before it passed. We're seeing that bleed over into a branch of government that, constitutionally speaking, is supposed to be the most removed from sort of the rancor of politics and the most removed from sort of the mob of the people and make its own decisions based upon the constitutionality. So that war of words will continue until the court makes a decision in June.
Well, speaking of health, Devin Katayama, a new report on health in Kentucky ranks Jefferson County lower than many of its neighbors, but says Kentucky's eastern counties are most in need of improvements.
Yeah, this report's coming from the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They've been keeping statistics for about 3 years now, and it's really for states to look at counties within their state and to basically compare within the counties. So they don't do as much state-by-state comparisons, but what you definitely see is poor health in the eastern 20 or so eastern counties that make up the lowest of the 120 counties in Kentucky. The report kind of drew from some new information. Usually in the past 2 years, they've been using a lot of statistics based on premature deaths, the general amount of healthcare, accessibility to healthcare. Now they're also adding information such as the number of fast food restaurants within a certain amount of area, a more comprehensive look at health within the counties in a state. And then when you also look at Jefferson County, which is ranked 33rd, and it hasn't moved much over the past 3 years, you do see it's surrounded by a large group of the most healthy states in, or excuse me, counties in the state. Number one being Oldham County, which has moved from number two to number one. I talked to Jody Mitchell, who's the executive director of Kentucky Voices for Health, and she says the socioeconomic factors are really what seem to be drawing Jefferson County down, because when you look at the access to clinical care, Jefferson County actually ranks number two. So this report isn't really new in the eyes of people like Jody Mitchell, who sees, you know, health data constantly, but it is kind of turning an eye on the situation that more is needed to be done. And she says, you know, the first step is going to be to really have individuals take a look at their own health, which, you know, you can only take so far.
Right. And this this data was collected over a three-year period?
Yeah, they've been collecting data for over 3 years. They actually released a new site, a new look of it, which makes it really user-friendly if you go on their website there. So you know, I encourage everyone to kind of check that out.
All right. Let's turn to Erin Keene, our WFPL Arts and Humanities reporter. She's been busy with the Humana Festival of New American Plays that has ended. That was pretty much, you jumped right in. That was your first assignment since joining us, and you jumped right in. But I want to look back a little bit because some awards were handed out at the end.
Right? Yeah, the last weekend is the second of two industry weekends. And on the final Saturday night of the festival, they do the 3 10-minute play world premieres, but they also hand out some awards. The American Theater Critics Association, ATCA, hands out the Steinberg Awards, which are funded by Harold and Mimi Steinberg Charitable Trust. And this is a huge new play award, $25,000 for the first place, and then two citations, two runners-up at $7,500 each. And it was actually one of the runner-ups that was the big story, at least for us, for the evening. Ray Pamatmat's play, Edith Can Shoot Things and Hit Them, opened in last year's Humana Festival, and that play was one of the runner-up citations. So it's one of the top three new plays that premiered outside of New York City in the last year, according to professional theater critics in the U.S. And so that's kind of, I mean, it's a big deal for Pamatmat, who just has recently in the last year made the jump from having to have a day job to being able to just write full time. But it's a big deal for the Humana Festival, too, because, you know, this is the 36th festival, and back in the day when John Jory founded the Humana Festival, there weren't a lot of showcases for new work in America outside of New York. And now there are lots of new play festivals. And so for one of the Steinberg citations to come out of the Humana Festival just sort of reaffirms that this is still one of the premier places to see new theatrical work in the U.S.
And the assessments of this year's festival have been positive?
Yeah, pretty positive. It hasn't been a very experimental festival as far as style goes. It's been a little bit comedy, a little bit drama. You know, it's always sort of a mixed bag like that. But the show that's still up is Michael von Siebenberg, Melts Through the Floorboards by Greg Kotis. It has an extended run through the 15th, and it's funny, and it's a great production, and I think that, you know, fans of medieval humor and vampires will enjoy it.
And while we have you here, there's a new documentary out on Ear Ecstasy.
Yes. Scott Shuffit is a Louisville filmmaker, and his documentary is called Brick and Mortar and Love. I guess those are the building materials that Shuffit says are needed to create an independent record store. Scott started making this film a couple of years ago in 2010 after Ear Ecstasy sort of publicly said, hey, we're in trouble, we're struggling. And he had hoped that it would help be a tool, a sort of rally cry for folks to really start helping the store out financially. But of course, Ear Ecstasy closed. Scott finished the film, and it includes lots of interviews with record store owners and managers and industry folks from all over the country, really taking a look at the health of the independent record store, what the industry is like, and what the struggles are facing kind of all over, and then using John Timmons' Ear Ecstasy story as the sort of the focal point to show the, kind of the end.
Ear Ecstasy, of course, one of the better known independent record stores, or music stores, I should say. I'm an old fashioned guy, so it's still
Me
say
too.
Record vinyl. music stores in the country closed recently. This film is going to be opening at a film festival, I understand, later this month.
It is. There's a public screening at the Science Center on Saturday. You do need to get your tickets ahead of time. So if Louisville folks want, they're going to get to see it first. And then Scott's taking it to the Nashville Film Festival later this month. He's still shopping it around to other festivals as well. So hopefully it'll see a lot of exposure throughout the country.
All right. Thanks, Erin. Gabe Bullard, back to you. It was disclosed this week that a couple of dozen of employees of the Courier-Journal and the Gannett Corporation have accepted buyouts.
Yes, we heard earlier in the year, around February or so, that Gannett was offering buyouts to hundreds of employees nationwide at all the newspapers it owns, and that they said that 20 would be accepted at the Courier. They said that there were 46 people who were eligible. To be eligible, you have to have 20 years of service or more with Gannett and be 56 years or older. It turns out that Gannett accepted 26 buyouts at the Courier. These are essentially early retirement plans where people who qualified could volunteer. They would receive 2 weeks of pay for every year they've been with the company up to 1 year. They would also receive some health benefits and all of that for their service to Gannett. But this is also a way for Gannett, which is not happy with the way its revenues have been lately, to cut down on some of the higher salaries. What this means at the Courier is that 26 people will be leaving. 18 of them are from the news department or from the news division at the Courier. And of those 18, 17 positions will not be filled again. They're being cut permanently. Sometimes when there are buyouts, younger people are brought in to replace some of the folks who are retiring, but not in this case. So there are 17 news positions leaving from the Courier. Some departments are down to, in the case of the editorial department, one person now. There's only one person on the editorial page at this point.
Any names we might recognize who accepted buyouts?
Quite a few, yes. So the people who volunteered, opinion page editor Keith Runyon and editor of editorial Steve Ford, those are two that are among the most talked about who have accepted these buyouts. Rick Manning, the online production manager, he's actually staying a little bit longer. Everyone else will be leaving in the next week or so, but Rick Manning will stay on as Gannett begins to transition toward its new model for its community newspapers. At the Courier, that means a paywall will be coming up at some point. It's not exactly known when that's happening, but some articles will be only available to paid subscribers to the website. Also, Larry Muhammad, a features writer, he has left. Harry Bryan, the sports editor. Mike Upsall, the Metro editor, or one of the Metro editors. Patrick Howington, a reporter. Arlene Jacobson, the special publications editor. And Ken Neuhauser, another features reporter, have also left.
Well, we're always sorry to hear of our colleagues being downsized, but we wish them well in their future endeavors. Devin, we're going to finish up with you on the kind of the flip side here. There's some activity at the Ford Louisville Assembly Plant, some exciting news there.
Yeah, it's an exciting time if you got a job at the Louisville Assembly Plant. It's an exciting time if you were laid off in 2010 and now you're coming back. There's now going to be about 3,000 employees that are, many of those are training right now, doing simulated training for next year for when production of the 2013 Ford SUV Escape will begin. And this is partly the $600 million investment that Ford decided to invest in Louisville after the contract, the new Ford, the union contract was agreed to last year. some members of the union are a little bit they criticized the contract when it came out. It gave up several concessions that they had to kind of forego when the federal when danger of getting a federal bailout. What's going to be happening is over the next few months, they're going to be seeing how the market demand is going to be for the new Ford Escape, which is actually supposed to be out in dealers by May. If that goes well, they're going to continue to hire for a third line, which is actually supposed to start working on the weekends because they don't have enough time and shifts during the weekdays. So that will happen sometime later this year.
Well, of course, the company making a $600 million investment in the plant.
It's a big investment. They have about $240 million worth of state incentives that they're getting back. So that was another reason why they decided on Louisville and the Louisville Assembly Plant to invest in.
All right, Devin Katayama, Gabe Bullard, Aaron Keene, Philip M. Bailey, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Great job, as always. Thanks. We're going to end on a fun note here with Devin Katayama, who's been visiting the world of roller derby. Roller derby has existed for over seven decades, but in the last 7 years, the sports league's popularity and personalities have grown. The Derby City Roller Girls at Louisville have played to packed crowds since 2006, and many of those fans think the game is an act, but not Devin. He went to a recent match and has this report.
Roller derby has the feel of an old WWF wrestling match.
DC!
But that's exactly what players like Melodrama say is the biggest misconception.
I think a lot of people still have the vision of the old roller derby on the track where they were throwing elbows and punching people, and you know, we don't do any of that. It's a sport with rules, and if you did any of the stuff that they did back then, you would be ejected from the game.
Roller derby has taken several forms since the 1930s, and over that time it has been perceived as more of a show than a sport. Women knocked each other around like pro wrestlers, and in some cases the teams even knew the outcome of matches before they started. But the rules have remained pretty consistent. The point of roller derby is to get your team's lead player, called a jammer, to lap members of the other team to collect points. And while parts of roller derby's history haven't gone away, like the aggressive image, the sport itself has evolved.
It's more sport-oriented, you know, a lot more strategy. Strategy is a huge thing. When we first joined, it was go out and hit. Go out and kill the jammer. That was the only thing.
The Derby City Roller Girls blocker Little Bo Teeps says the team spends hours a week practicing, even reviewing tape.
We have set up for our league now. It's Derby City Roller Girls training. It's a private YouTube viewing where we upload our practices, we upload our games, and we require girls to go on and watch and see what's going on. And that's also going to help us get better every game.
The team they're playing tonight uses social media too. Coco Sparks is a blocker for the Burning River Roller Girls from Cleveland. She says she Facebook stalks players from other teams.
Especially if there's a game coming up, like I take a look at their profile, maybe look at their history and try and get a handle on how they're feeling. It's not a totally accurate, obviously, because no one's going to go on there and be like, I feel like garbage today, our team sucks, you know, but it's good to get a feel for how they're feeling about their teams.
The Derby City Roller Girls were established in 2006 as part of the Women's Fast Track Derby Association, which represents nearly 150 teams worldwide. But the association seems pretty lax. Little Rage of Sunshine says the teams pay to play, and they're each responsible for setting their own schedules.
We're a do-it-yourself league. All our women skaters also run our committees and our boards. We have promotion, we have about committee, we have merchandise, training, all that stuff that goes into making the outer parts of the league aside from the skating.
This week, the team starts its biannual boot camp. Lil Rage of Sunshine says of the 15 girls that will come out, it's likely only a few will make it through.
And if they can master those skills in rookie camps, the falling, the hitting, the skating is obviously, you know, all those things, we're going to put them through for 8 weeks. Then they'll go on to scrimmage camp.
Louisville's team is ranked near the bottom of the league. That's partly because they're just now beginning to expand like teams in larger cities. Their opponents, the Burning River Roller Girls, draw from Cleveland's four smaller roller derby teams to make up their traveling team. Before the game, the team meets in the quietest room in the roller rink. The girls sit geared up, listening to Lil Bo Teep's pep talk.
This is our time to do it, okay? It's okay that they're ranked higher than us. It's okay. We want this more. We've been working hard.
But the Burning River Roller Girls, they're too quick and strong.
Burning River once again securing lead jammer status right out of the gate.
The word strategy seems to fall apart during the game, but several fans don't seem to mind. And on the sideline, a former player turned referee, Vintage Viv, tells me she turned to the dark side just to have a chance to stay connected to the game, and she looks on in admiration.
I wish they would have started back when I was in my 30s, but unfortunately they didn't. It's going to be interesting to see what it's like when I'm 60 or 70 years old, because I have a feeling it's going to be around for a long time.
Devin Katayama, WFPL News.
We now return to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett, and we turn our attention now to the environment. And here to talk about some of the latest news on that front is WFPL's Erica Peterson. And we're joined by James Bruggers of the Courier-Journal. Welcome back, Jim. Good to see you again. Let's start with you, Jim. You reported recently that the Ohio River, according to at least one study, leads the nation now in the amount of toxic chemicals dumped into it by industries.
Yeah, that was a study that was done by an organization called Environment America. They did one 3 years ago, and they took toxics release inventory data. This is industry-reported pollution data that they have to provide to the EPA. And they looked at, they kind of divided it up by how much went to each river and each watershed across the country. And, well, we're number one again. And we were three years ago as well, the Ohio River was.
Where does most of this stuff come from?
Majority of it actually is from two different steel mills, one in Rockport, Indiana, an AK Steel, and another one in Carroll County, Kentucky. Most of it is nitrates. Nitrates, it's can actually cause blue baby syndrome, but not at levels that are found in the Ohio River. And of course, that's something that drinking water treatment plants are able to deal with. But the nitrates do go down to the Gulf of Mexico, and there they contribute to this oxygen depleted dead zone that we all know about, and they can cause algae blooms as well.
Hmm. What other rivers or waterways are on this list? High on this list?
Well, the Mississippi River was number two, and the New River was number three, and that's in Virginia, I believe.
Now, you mentioned drinking water, and I think you talked to someone from the Louisville Water Company as part of your piece, and they say that the drinking water is safe regardless of how much stuff we have in the river.
Yes. Yeah, they do.
Eric, on a related note, reported this week there was a big sewage spill in the Ohio River.
Yeah, exactly. Ties in pretty well to the idea that there's a lot of stuff in the Ohio River that's not necessarily supposed to be there. There was about 2.5 million gallons of untreated sewage was released into the Ohio on Wednesday morning. There's about 44 minutes where it was going in there.
Jim, we've come a long way. There was talk about the Ohio River being an open sewer.
It was an open sewer. Millions of people, just what they flushed down their toilets 40 years ago, went right into the Ohio River. Industries didn't have to really curtail their discharges. Fish at that point, people tell me that when they fish, they would catch fish that they would smell like diesel fuel. They would taste like diesel fuel.
Yum.
So yeah, it's it's come a long way. Which of course, I think you're going to ask me about this other story with the Eagles.
Yes, yeah, I was saving that for a little later.
But, never mind. Sorry.
We'll make that transition in just a moment. But I do want to talk about the water some more because I want to move on to chromium-6.
Okay.
Now, the EPA, you also wrote about this, is delaying adoption of a drinking water standard for, this is called hexavalent chromium.
Yeah, there's a national standard for total chromium, but there's several different types of chromium, and there's one type, chromium-6, which has been linked to certain types of cancer. And it's been an issue more out west and particularly California. Erin Brockovich made it famous in the movie that she was in. Anyway, it became an issue locally a couple of years ago when the Environmental Working Group identified Louisville as a city that was had some chromium-6 in its drinking water at levels that California would say is unsafe. And so that prompted kind of a sleuthing effort on the part of the Louisville Water Company, and they figured out that that it had to do with their treatment process at their Payne plant, which is their new plant, and they've tweaked the treatment process. They've gotten the chromium levels down considerably, I think people really don't have to be too terribly concerned about that.
So is it back down below what's acceptable California?
No, it's still a little bit above that.
Uh-huh.
We're going to have to wait a little longer for the EPA to actually set a standard on it. They're going to do a couple, three more years of research. Industry fought back, and there's some industry-funded research that they want to look at. And none of this stuff ever goes very quickly. But at some point, well, you know, in the next 2 or 3 years, we'll hear where the EPA wants to take us on chromium.
All right, Erica, let's move from water to air, because you wrote this week that an agreement between the federal government and environmental groups will limit pollution from some power plants that creates haze at HAZE at national parks. Is this a big problem at the parks?
Yeah, at some parks, I guess it is. I can't say I've been to every, you know, every large national park in the country yet. But basically what happened is in the Clean Air Act initially, there were supposed to be plans in place by 2007 to deal with haze in national parks. And the idea is that national parks are supposed to be, you know, these beautiful natural places, and people go to them to escape the cities, to escape air pollution that you often find in cities, and they should have clean air. So basically, what this agreement does is it sets up. There are a whole bunch of states that are affected by it, and they will have to comply with new plans. They're going to have to put limits on some of their power plants and factories. The ones that models have shown are basically blowing pollution directly into power plants directly into national parks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And one of the parks that is on this list as, you know, one that needs to be cleaned up is Mammoth Cave in Kentucky.
Hmm. Are there others in Kentucky that are affected?
No, that is the only national park in Kentucky. There are the next closest one, the Dolly Sods Wilderness Area in West Virginia, is on the list as well. And most of them, though, are out west.
I see. Now let's move on to the bald eagles. And this is a very interesting story, because I don't think of this part of Kentucky, Jim, as being a haven for bald eagles. But you reported that some bald eagles are nesting near the route of the proposed East End Bridge.
Yeah, earlier I was getting so excited to talk about this recovery that the Ohio River Valley's been undergoing. When you have, there's a lot more fish, there's more fish, the aquatic life has bounced back in the Ohio to a great degree. And it actually meets water quality standards on many days in certain areas. So the Ohio River Valley has become something of a bald eagle corridor. There's now some 16 or 17 that are in, at least along the Kentucky stretch, and as well as Indiana, 16 or 17 nesting pairs. As recently as 30 years ago, there were no nesting pairs at all in either state, Indiana or Kentucky, and now there's some 250 nesting pairs. And there's four in Jefferson County in Louisville, and there's really not been a record of, well, there's three and two in Jefferson County and then two nearby. That there's not been a record of them in Jefferson County before nesting, and one of them happened to pick a spot that was right next to the construction zone of the eastern alignment of the of the eastern bridge.
So what are officials proposing doing to
avoid disturbance? Well, they're scrambling to figure out exactly what to do, but they probably will, at least what they tell me they probably will do is, they may not be able to actually do some construction work in that immediate area during the nesting season. It's not a large area, so they can kind of reschedule. They're not going to be able to maybe cut down certain trees that might, you know, they're going to look to make sure they don't cut down trees that the eagles use as hunting perches. And and the contractor may have some conditions written into their contract, when the construction contract. So, it's actually a pretty, you know, amazing story when you think about all these eagles that are here, and they're now living in the city, which
that is amazing.
When eagles nest, Jim, I mean they have a nesting season, but then do they come back every year, or how does that work?
I think for several years they do come back.
Wow, so this could be kind of an issue for a while.
Yes, and interestingly enough, I don't know when these eagles actually were. There's conflicting reports on when these eagles showed up. Excuse me. But there's no mention of them in any of the environmental studies that have been done out there. So I don't know if that's a problem or not. But we're told by the Fish and Wildlife Service that they don't think that this will delay the construction at all. So,
And the exact locations of these nests aren't being disclosed publicly, because gawkers could disturb the eagles.
Yes, gawkers could. The place where they're at is just not set up to deal with the public. It's the private property, and so
I see. We're going to end on that note. James Bruggers of the Courier Journal, Erica Peterson, WFPO Environment Reporter. Thank you both for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. We return now to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett, and we're joined now with BIA, Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston. Kenny, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Kenny with us in person today as the General Assembly is in, you call this veto recess?
Yeah, I think that'd be an appropriate term. They're waiting to see what the governor signs and what he vetoes, and they'll come back next week and decide whether or not they want to override any of those vetoes.
Well, it's been a quiet veto week, hasn't it? We haven't heard much out of the governor.
Yeah, it's been very quiet. I don't know if it's a combination of basketball early in the week and now later in the week we're kind of around Easter time, but it's been very quiet. He's signed maybe six or seven bills, smaller issues that aren't really controversial. He signed them kind of the middle of the week, and I expect that means that next week we're going to see a very busy week. That veto pen will probably get a workout, especially in the budget bills.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the bills that have been passed or that or have not been passed. The auto incentives bill, what is that and what's going on with it?
Well, that bill the governor signed on, I believe, yesterday. And basically what it does is it provides millions of dollars to auto companies that meet certain thresholds. You have to have 1,000 employees, you have to be in business in Kentucky for 5 years, and you have to be willing to invest $100 million in your Kentucky businesses. So basically, it's a wide program, but it's a small one at the same time. This is what led Ford to invest in these Louisville plants, both their plants to help them retool, to help them hire shifts again, you know, second and third shifts. And now this law allows that to happen for Toyota, for General Motors, and two of the biggest suppliers, auto suppliers here in Kentucky. Toyota is really a big fan of this. They can do this tomorrow if they want to. They say it makes them competitive internally. If Toyota wants to build a new plant in the United States, you know, Kentucky would obviously, if they built that plant, that would qualify for these incentives. If they want to start a new car line, they can do it here in Kentucky to get these incentives. And so everyone seems to be rallying around this, and it's a really kind of a slam dunk proposal.
Now, early on in the session, there was a big push for the creation of charter schools, lots of advertising. That bill appeared to be dead for a while, but where is it now?
Well, it seemed that it was going to, there was a deal on the table for a pilot project, something like 20 charter schools statewide in the last few days. But when they tried to attach that bill to another bill that House Education Chairman Carl Rollins had, he kind of got a little frustrated and upset and declared both of those issues dead on arrival. And in the last day, you know, obviously there's negotiating to get bills out of both chambers. And so basically that charter school amendment on one of Rollins' bills was taken off of it, so that the Senate could get one of their education bills through the House. So basically, supporters are saying it's dead for this legislative session since there's only one day left, but they promise they're going to come back in 2013 even harder than they did this year.
And what about, there was a bill for Cole County scholarships. What's that about?
That one's actually, that one might be in trouble. I mean, there seemed to be an agreement on the table for this bill to get out as part of budget negotiations. It was originally, you know, we were talking about the University of Pikeville becoming a state school. That didn't work. So they created this scholarship program for 12 to 16 Far Eastern Kentucky counties, and that seemed to be okay. They would pay coal severance tax money, but in budget negotiations, the Senate changed that a little bit, and from there, what they've done is they've expanded to all coal mining or coal producing counties. That's 38 counties in all. You're talking about Eastern Kentucky, Western Kentucky. That was part of the budget negotiations. And then suddenly, on the last day, last Friday, that bill does not pop out of the Senate like it's supposed to, like everybody planned on it. The Senate says it just got lost in the shuffle, but there's a little concern on the House side that that bill's either being held hostage or could die once again this coming up Thursday.
You've done some political reporting. You've had a chance to catch your breath a little bit from all the legislative activities, and you've been talking a little bit about the 4th District primary. This is the 4th District congressional race.
That's right, yeah, which actually now, you know, is kind of like a cap on the state. I mean, it already was, but now it shoots all the way in eastern Jefferson County, all the way down to Spencer, and then it goes all the way to Ashland on the whole other side of the state. And so this primary has, you know, a bunch of Republicans in it. That's really where the race is. It's a Republican district. And these Republicans have finally started going after each other. I guess they realize the spotlight's on them. And they've been, Gary Moore, who's the Boone County Judge Executive in Northern Kentucky, accused state lawmaker Alicia Webb Edgington, who's also running for that seat, you know, she missed the budget votes. And Moore says that, you know, she was in D.C. fundraising, she was in Shelbyville fundraising, and that's really kind of, I guess you're not doing your responsibilities as state lawmaker if you're not there to vote on the one bill that you're required by law to vote on. Of course, Alicia Webb, the Edgerton's campaign, has said we're going to file those votes when we get back. We're going to vote no. They won't change the outcome, so they're not that important. And so they're kind of battling back and forth. Thomas Massey, who is kind of seen as the Tea Party guy in that race, has picked up a few endorsements. He's kind of, you know, in forums, he's kind of throwing a few punches. So these Republicans are starting to get at each other's throats. And I assume that the rhetoric will just increase more and more as we get to May 22nd.
And of course, the presidential race continues to drone on or heat up, depending on your perspective. But an Obama for America office is now opened in Kentucky.
That's right. The office is opening. It has its grand opening tomorrow here in Louisville on Barrett Avenue, I think from 2 to 4. And basically, the Obama campaign, you know, make no mistake about it, most people believe Kentucky is a Republican red state when it comes to presidential politics. And I don't feel like the Obama campaign feels any differently, but they say they have a nationwide campaign. They're going to compete in all 50 states, and they say opening a Kentucky office proves that we're going to compete in all 50 states. Say it'll be a statewide office for, you know, not just the Louisville office. It'll serve the whole state. And they even kind of hinted they might open more offices in the future. I'm sure resources and time and how well they're doing in the race all dictates that, but they said you could possibly see, you know, Lexington offices or other offices out in the state, which would actually be contributing a lot more resources than people believe the Obama campaign will play here in Kentucky. So they've got their first office open for Kentucky. It'll be interesting to see how much they do here on out.
If I remember right, in 08, the president carried Louisville and Lexington and nothing else, but he didn't campaign in Kentucky. Hillary Clinton won the primary.
Right, yeah, and I believe, you know, he did make one visit to Louisville in 08 at the Kentucky International Convention Center. That was a big thing here in Louisville. He has First Lady Michelle Obama was in Louisville, you know, a month ago fundraising. Mm-hmm. The president went to Northern Kentucky to talk about the Northern Kentucky bridges, you know, Vice President Joe Biden has done events at like GE and U of L that have been more official vice presidential duties. So he's not completely ignored the state, but he's hitting the border areas because, of course, as we know, Louisville borders Indiana, which is a battle state. Northern Kentucky, you know, borders Ohio, which is a battle state. And Lexington's just one of those good old, you know, Democratic areas where you can get a lot of people to do the phone calls and lick the envelopes and everything else. And that's where he's staying, where he knows he's safe.
Well, one quick legislative question before we let you go. We're in the veto recess. Lawmakers come back to where they can override vetoes. Can they pass any legislation during this time?
Yeah, they actually can, but they don't have any safety over it. So if it's a bill that the governor does not like, you know, obviously he can veto it. That's the concern about the Cole County scholarships we talked about. That's also a concern about the prescription pill bill, House Bill 4, that we've talked about, that, you know, they won't have that protection. And lawmakers have gotten really nervous because in the past few cycles they've, you know, passed budgets without veto protection, and it makes them really nervous because this governor has shown that he's not afraid to use his veto pen. So any bills that haven't been already passed, even if the governor says he supports them, there's always that chance that they could be amended and he could just take his little red pen and X them out.
All right. Kenny Colston is the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio, which includes WFPL. Kenny, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.